This is number 0051, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0051. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Alison Arngrim, actress and author, best known for her role as that mean Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. She talks about her book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. What was the toughest thing about doing that show?
Doing any TV show or movie that takes place in the 1800s is going to be physically uncomfortable. Those clothes are not fun in California 110 degree heat, and I wore a wig on the show. It was an absolute torture device. I had a big metal comb in the front. It was the most uncomfortable thing you could ever have on your head, and we shot out in Simi Valley. So, you know, whenever I see anyone doing a period film now, 1700s or 1800s, I just wince in pain for the actors. So it was one of the most physically challenging things I ever had to do. It was a very hard show to be on physically, but emotionally, it was the greatest show to be on in the world.
We'll also have a return visit with author Chris Epting. His new book is called Hello, It's Me, a book that chronicles his contact with many celebrities, including the time as a child he literally ran into Alfred Hitchcock.
I'm running around the hotel, the Century Plaza Hotel, and a guy comes in the front door who I don't see, and I run like flush into his stomach. I literally kind of bounce off of it. And I always remember as a kid thinking there's two kinds of adults, the kind that will just sort of brush that off and laugh about it, and then those that get really ticked off. And this guy was the latter. This guy was not happy. Quickly said to me, you know, where are your parents? Sort of yelling at me. And I look up and it's Alfred Hitchcock. And I indicate where my folks, they're checking in the lobby there. And he marches me over there, kind of like, I mean, if he didn't pick up like the back of my neck the way like the dean would have some very proper English sporting school or something. That's how he kind of took me over there. My parents look across and see us coming, and they're thinking, how, you know, what's he gotten himself into?
Actor and impressionist Josh Robert Thompson is on the program. Where did his life of impressions start?
When I was young, about 7 or 8 years old, you know, I sort of caught the tail end of the variety show era. So I was watching a lot of Tim Conway, Carol Burnett, Rich Little, and studying what they were doing. And I was also an only child. That's a very important part of this. If you're an only child, it helps a lot because I had a lot of time on my hands. And I had a Fisher-Price tape recorder, and I would basically just record my voice into the tape recorder and mimic what I saw on television. So it was really just TV that inspired me to do this.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0051, is Java James Jacobs, part of the morning show on K103 with Ted, Java, and Paul. Heard weekday mornings from 5:30 to 10 a.m. on K103 Gunawage, 103.7 FM, and online at K103radio.com. Check out their regular features such as Revisionist History, which you can hear at 7:40 and 9:40 on the program. And thank you very much, Java, for being the guest Slater on this edition of the show. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Yes, and we start off with a story of motherly love. Actually, a couple of stories dealing with motherly love, or lack thereof. Renee Collins, age 49, was arrested in Las Vegas in June and charged with beating her 16-year-old daughter with a cane. The arresting officer quoted Collins' explanation, "That bleep owes me $50 for rent." Nice parenting skills. Nice parenting skills. Meanwhile, police arrested Christina Muniz, age 29, in Sunrise, Arizona in June, after being summoned to the home by Muniz's son, who was 11. Muniz had just informed the boy and his brother, who was age 6, that she was abandoning them to move to California with her boyfriend to fulfill her dream to become a stripper. With police watching, the older boy approached Muniz for a hug, but she slugged him in the stomach. Nice parenting skills. Nice parenting skills. Okay, let's move on to religion and nice preachers, shall we? Or maybe not. In Warner Robins, Georgia, one pastor is on a crusade against something sacred to many in his community: high school football. The problem is the city's oldest high school, which also happens to have one of the most successful football programs in Georgia. It rallies around a green-eyed, pitchfork-carrying demon. Yes, the team is called the Warner Robins Demons, and Pastor Donald Crosby of Kingdom Builders Church of Jesus Christ was shocked, I say, when he realized his own son could be among the hundreds of students shouting, "Go Demons!" to cheer on the team. The preacher, who has lived in the town for about a year, has tried to move his ninth grade son to a different school, one with a mascot more to the family's liking. In the meanwhile, he is collecting signatures on a petition to change the symbol. And just for the record, the history books show the Air Force paid to have the high school built back in 1946, and the mascot was chosen to honor the 7th Fighter Squadron, the Screaming Demons, which came to Robins Air Force Base for repairs. Houston County school officials said it was unlikely the mascot would be changed. Translation: go to hell, Mr. Preacher Man, and stop being such an overzealous nut. Okay, moving right along. Jamie Harms, age 34, had been the executive assistant to CEO John Smith of the developer Hearthstone Homes. She filed a lawsuit against the Omaha, Nebraska company in June for wrongful firing. Now, according to the lawsuit, Smith told Harms that after consulting with psychics, he was troubled by her pregnancy. He said he was feeling negative energy from her fetus, sensing that it was hostile towards him, and causing him to be reminded of his own unpleasant experience as a fetus. His own unpleasant experience as a fetus? Really? And this guy is a CEO of something? Anything? Whack job. I think she's going to win that suit. Just guessing. Moving right along, in Atlanta, police say the guy who robbed a Wendy's restaurant with a gun was so mad about the amount of money he got away with that he called back twice to complain. Our friend allegedly walked up to the drive-through window wearing a ski mask and holding a gun. He demanded the cash drawer, grabbed it, and ran away. But police say he later called the fast food restaurant to complain, and during one call said that next time there better be more than $586. That seems like a pretty good haul for a drive-through window, but I digress. Not that I know. He called again with a similar complaint. You know, robbers can't be choosers. Really, when you think about it. Okay, provincial police in Ontario received a report of a truck driving erratically near Sarnia. They found the truck and pulled it over and found that the unnamed driver was doing some amateur tooth pulling while driving. Constable John Rurink said the 58-year-old trucker had a toothache and had tied one end of a string around the tooth and the other to the roof of the cab and told the officer that one bump and the tooth should come out. Sure enough, said the officer, the evidence of his efforts were nearby, with a bloody tooth and a string sitting on the seat. The truck driver was cited for careless driving. Home dentistry, or in this case, on-the-road dentistry. You know, they say people shouldn't be doing a lot of things behind the wheel, texting, talking on the phone, putting on makeup. Pulling their own tooth, though, I'm sure never came up in court before. Not even a thought. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, it's fun to lie on your back at night and just gaze up at the stars, isn't it? Well, that is unless you're high on PCP and lying in the middle of the road at the time. That's what a 25-year-old New Jersey man was doing when he was struck and run over by a Cadillac. The driver told police he saw something in the road that looked like a small box, and when he drove over it, he immediately realized it was something more substantial. The victim was rushed to the hospital, where his injuries proved to be not as bad as you'd think. Amazingly, he was treated and released by 7 a.m. the next morning. The driver of the car won't be charged with anything except a citation because his driver's license had expired 2 days earlier. So there you go. We're going to get to our first guest on the Stuff File program in just a moment. But first, I want to say a quick thanks to Bob S. in Chateauguay. That's Chateauguay, Quebec, right here in this province, for his generous donation to the Stuff File program. It's very much appreciated, and it goes a long way in helping to keep this show up and running. So thank you very much, Bob S., and also some other people who have donated to the program in the past. Now, let's get to our first guest on the program, shall we? On the line with us right now is actress Alison Arngrim, and she has a new book out. It's called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. I just love saying that title. The subtitle is How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. She is very, very busy these days on a book tour, but has taken the time to talk to us right here, right now. Hi, Alison. How are you?
Oh, I am very good. I'm just absolutely in a state. This book is, people love it. I'm getting great reviews. People are buying the thing, and I've got the world's longest book tour. I mean, it came out in June, and I'm heading out to Las Vegas day after tomorrow.
Well, you say people love it, and you almost sound like you're surprised by that fact.
Well, you know, every actor, every actor and writer always says, "Oh, wouldn't it be great? I could write a book, and people will somehow get it, and they'll really like it, and your greatest fear is if you tell people what you really like, then they won't like you anymore. So you hope, what if I really tell them what I really like and write a book, and people like it? But then, you know, they did. It's like they're reading the thing, they're loving it. And I mean, yeah, before it got published, I had a few people read it and said, you know, this is really good, right? And I went, I think I put a lot of work into it. But the response has just been overwhelming. I am thrilled to pieces. I was just at Mall of America and St. Louis Public Library and had people yelling and screaming and carrying on. It's just great.
Now, I've had the opportunity over the years to talk to a lot of actors, especially actors who have played what might be considered villains or bad people. And you played Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. And the thing I've always noticed about people who play less than lovable characters is they seem to be, off camera, the nicest people you ever come across. And I mean that from the point of view, nicer than the average person.
Isn't that weird? I have noticed that, too. I have noticed when I've run into people who play the villain, they're always, like, the sweetest person. And I think in my case, it was like getting it out of my system. I had somewhere to vent all of these negative emotions and all this anger and rage. And I think that maybe people who play villains, certainly the ones who do it well, they've had time to think about it. They're sort of, you know, psychiatrists are always talking about getting in touch with your dark side. We're properly in touch with our dark side, and we know the difference between niceness and badness, and we have somewhere to put all that dark stuff. So when we're not doing it, we're not compelled to be nasty to people. We don't need to. We have somewhere to go do that.
Now, you wrote this book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, many, many years after being on Little House on the Prairie. Why not write it earlier? Why write it now?
Well, I'd sort of been working on it earlier. I know the first time I wrote anything was, I guess, after Michael Landon died. I think a lot of us did start thinking about, you know, what the show meant and what he meant to us all. And I started writing some stuff then and just put it aside. And then when I started doing my one-woman show, because I have a stand-up act and a one-woman show called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch that I tour with, and when I started writing that, more and more real stories from my life, I thought, ooh, better write the long version. But it was just a matter of timing. I'd been working on it, and I maybe could have done it back in, I don't know, 2004, I don't know, but the timing wasn't right. Then everything happened at once. The musical of Little House on the Prairie came out, and just it became prairie fever everywhere. Melissa Gilbert had just gotten her book deal, and I had met various literary agents, but I finally met this wonderful guy, Kent D. Wolfe, who's fabulous and really got it. And he just said, well, this book, it just happened now. Let's do this. And next thing I know, it's with HarperCollins. And it was the timing was right. It was like just the prairie planets all got aligned, like the popularity of the show and everything was going on, and it just hit the fan at exactly the right time, and it worked out perfectly. It's bizarre how well it worked out.
Now, when it comes to writing a book, and you deal with publicists and agents and editors, and they're telling you what they want or what they don't want, was it a difficult process to say, well, okay, I'm going to tell about this, but I'm not going to tell everything, or did you have to just spill your guts?
I'm a gut spiller anyway. I went for it. I mean, you know, people talk about how hard it is to write 70,000 words. I handed in 130,000. They actually had to cut it down. They said, we can't fit this in one book. They'll need a hand truck to wheel it out of the store. I totally spilled my guts, and I was really pleased. The publisher and the editors didn't say, oh, you can't talk about that. They actually, we cut stuff for space, but then they said, actually, we'd like to go back and expand this, talking about AIDS, talking about my relationship with Steve Tracy, who played my husband, Percival, in the show, and who died of AIDS in 1986. our relationship and how I got involved in AIDS activism. They love that. A lot of the really personal stuff, they said, actually, you can go further on that chapter if you'd like. If you'd like to write some more about that and call us in the morning. They were all for it. It was amazing. They didn't... I wasn't told to reveal anything that I hadn't already revealed, although I think I revealed everything. I just went all out. And they said, yes, this is what we want. We want the real thing. We want you raw, your sense of humor, the way you talk about stuff. They went, this is what the people want. So I was really pleased with how it all went.
Of course, as you mentioned, Steve Tracy is no longer with us. Also, yep. You mentioned Michael Landon is no longer with us. But of those who are... have you been in contact with them since you started writing the book or since the book has come out?
Yeah. Some of them, I mean, you know, Melissa Gilbert, because she was started writing hers, we were sort of comparing notes a couple times going, are you telling this story? I'm telling that one. Okay, and then we'd leave each other alone. But she actually reviewed it. I have a blurb on the back cover from Melissa Gilbert. She thought it was just the greatest thing ever. So she really liked it. And now I've heard from other cast members. I know Karen Grassley, who played Ma on the show, absolutely loved it, as did Charlotte Stewart, who played Miss Beadle. So gradually everybody's, emailing in. So they're all starting to read it now. Everybody's really pleased. And I mean, as it went to publication, I warned people, a few people, like, you know, you're in this. And they're like, what do you say? Do you tell any good stories? It seemed to be my reputation already, I guess, having been the comedian. And even on the show, Melissa Sue Anderson, who played Mary, was the pretty one. Melissa Gilbert was the smart one. I was the funny one. So pretty much the reaction I got from people who knew they were going to be in the book was, oh, good. Am I in it? Do I get a good story? Is it going to be funny? They weren't really worried. They were just, like, concerned that they didn't get enough airtime, you know.
So in those years you were on Little House on the Prairie, what could you say is the best thing about being on the show? And conversely, what's the worst thing about being on the show?
Well, the best thing, I mean, really was the character I got to play, that I got to play Nellie Olson, that I played this character where I was able to vent all of this angst. I mean, you know, I talk about in the book that I had been abused as a child, and I'd been beaten up by bullies at school, and here I was playing the bully. Here I was the aggressive, frightening person, and I had somewhere to go with all of this pain and rage, and now I was playing someone people were afraid of. So it really kind of turned my life around. The downside is... doing any TV show or movie that takes place in the 1800s is going to be physically uncomfortable. Those clothes are not fun in California 110-degree heat. And I wore a wig on the show. It was an absolute torture device. I had a big metal comb in the front. It was the most uncomfortable thing you could ever have on your head. And we shot out in Simi Valley. So, you know, whenever I see anyone doing a period film now, 1700s or 1800s, I just wince in pain for the actors. So it was one of the most physically challenging things I ever had to do. It was a very hard show to be on physically. But emotionally, it was the greatest show to be on in the world.
Now, a lot of times when kids work on sets, they have tutors and they don't have to go to school. But did you go to school when you weren't shooting?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I did both. I did go to school when I wasn't shooting. And that was actually a very smart move. I stayed in the school I was in. I had friends I'd known since the third grade. So I was in junior high when I got the show, and I stayed at junior high. I went on to Hollywood High, and I continued to go to school at least a little bit of the year, just part of the year, with people I'd known all my life. So that wasn't taken away, that environment. You know, it was erratic and very chaotic and difficult sometimes to follow certain subjects like algebra, because I'd be in school for a couple of weeks, then at work, then at school, then at work, and back and forth for a few days here, a few weeks there. But I kept contact with people who I'd known all my life, so I wasn't cut off from my entire, you know, community and the people I'd grown up with.
The reason I ask about the schooling is you mentioned earlier that you were bullied when you were a kid, and I was just wondering, how did things change for you, good, bad, or indifferent, when you got back to school after the explosion of being Nellie Olson? How did that change for life for you at school?
Well, luckily, my friends who I'd known for ages, they just thought it was just hilarious. Oh, Allison got a job. She's on Little House on the Prairie. But, or as my friend said, why can't you be on Joni Loves Chachi or something cool? Why do you have to be on Little House on the Prairie? But new people, it was more difficult. My first day at school after filming the show, after the first show aired, Country Girls, I walked onto the campus, and this girl actually yelled from the upper landing, "Yeah, bitch!" And this was my greeting at 8 o'clock in the morning. And that's when I realized, you know, I had to do something. I turned around, I looked up and said, thank you, and bowed. And I realized I was going to have to meet this head on. But it did work in my favor, because I later ran into these girls who were, well, gang members and were very rough and had beaten up a lot of people, and I'd gotten clobbered before by some of their friends. And one day they came up and they said, are you Alison Arngram? And I said, yeah. And they said, do you play Nellie Olson in Little House on the Prairie? And I thought maybe they'd had a hit put out on me or something, because they were calling me by name. And then they said, oh, we love your character. They loved my character. They went, oh, you're bad. You beat the crap out of that stupid Laura Ingalls. They had sort of adopted the character of Nellie Olson for them as a role model. These were girls who routinely beat people up. They thought it was cool that I did this. So suddenly I was no longer someone to beat up. I was someone to admire. So, like, the worst people found this role attractive, which was, you know, great for me. I suddenly, you know, didn't have to get clobbered on a regular basis.
I got one last question for you, and that is, if Little House on the Prairie, or let me back it up a little bit, going back to when you did Little House on the Prairie,
yes,
you and all those other kids on the show, if you had today's paparazzi, how would your life be different, or what would we be surprised to find out about you guys?
We definitely would have worse reputations than we have now. It's true. You know, back in the day, it's true. If you did something stupid, you know, it was the National Enquirer you had to deal with, but it took them days to put the issue together. They put it to bed on, like, Thursday. You had, like, 3 days to get your publicist to call the Enquirer and make a deal to, like, not run that photo, to not run that article. And, you know, and it was one or two entities. But now it's all this Radar Online and TMZ. So it's, you know, you fall down drunk and it's instantaneously up in 10 minutes. So I imagine we probably all would have gotten caught at something as teenagers or in our 20s, doing something. As it was, we were at least able to say cast a Little House, no arrest, no convictions. You know, now, in a way, it's sort of like, can a TMZ's become like the Jiminy Cricket conscience for people? You know, now it's like, don't do anything you wouldn't want to see on TMZ. We all have to sort of behave ourselves even more so. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what the great thing now, it's, Lisa, TMZ is very youth-focused. They don't really care who you're having sex with after 40. They really don't. They barely care who you're sleeping with after 30 on TMZ. If you're 40, unless you're inviting the entire Seventh Fleet over, TMZ is not going to come to your house and look.
Yeah, or if you're, so unless you're trolling at high schools,
right?
The book is called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. It's written by Alison Arngram. And Alison, it's always a pleasure to talk to you on the program.
It's so nice to talk to you. I'm so glad you have this show.
So glad to have you here. Alison Arngram, author of Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this program, which is 0051, and you'll find links to Allison's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Chris Epting, author of Hello, It's Me. Plus, we'll hear from Josh Robert Thompson, who's an actor and impressionist. That's all coming up on The Stuff File. Of course, an idiot of the day and more stuff right here, right now. Now, while some people may feel like superheroes on their wedding day, Sharon and Neil Vaughn actually were. At least they dressed the part. She donned an authentic Wonder Woman costume, and he went as Batman. The best man was dressed as Robin, and the Joker conducted the ceremony. And oh, it didn't stop there. All of Sharon's bridesmaids came as the Powerpuff Girls, while other guests included Superman, The Incredibles, Iron Man, The Incredible Hulk, and Captain America. This all went down in Devon, England, and Neil explained, "We are not particularly traditional, and we wanted to have a fun day with our friends, so I suggested we have a themed wedding. I have always wanted to be Batman ever since I was a little boy, and Sharon said she had always wanted to be Wonder Woman." The couple will honeymoon in Australia. Hopefully they'll be wearing regular clothes at the time. Airport security could be a problem otherwise. Okay, after a tip, sheriff's deputies got a search warrant for a home in Jackson, Mississippi. Sure enough, they found drugs. The homeowner, Millie Steverson, age 62, was arrested, even though she protested that she needs the pot to treat her glaucoma. Investigators note the haul from the house included 30 pounds of marijuana, plus crack cocaine, ecstasy, and a gun. And by the way, as a convicted felon, Steverson is not allowed to possess firearms. And a stolen car. Here's a quote from County Sheriff Malcolm McMillan. "I understand she smokes the drugs to help her glaucoma, but by the time she got through smoking all that, she would have X-ray vision." So, Sheriff, you're saying you saw right through her excuse then, is what you're saying, correct? Meanwhile, in East Sussex, England, police are searching for a man who made posters showing his manhood, complete with a yellow bow tied on it. The A3 size, which is 11.7 by 16.5 inches, these posters had been put up all over town. According to a quote here, "We have not received any formal complaints," this said a police spokesperson. "If this is a self-portrait, the artist won't be in a hurry to be identified." Well, that is correct, but if he has to make enlargements, how impressive can it be? That's all I'm saying. Moving right along, you know what they say, know your audience. Play to them. A Cleveland chapter of the Ohio Red Cross is taking that advice to heart to try to encourage blood donations. They're offering to people who donate a pint of blood the chance to win a new car or a horse-drawn buggy. Spokeswoman Christy Chapman says the Red Cross didn't want to leave its many Amish donors out of the giveaway. The organization's region includes three counties with one of the nation's largest Amish populations, and they have a board member who is Amish. That board member is arranging to have a buggy custom made for the contest, which wraps up September 6th. If you're not a horse-drawn buggy kind of guy or gal, you can choose a 2010 Nissan Versa. There you go. You go, Ezekiel. You go. And give the gift of life. In Lake Villa Township, Illinois, the Gomez family found out firsthand what it's like to be at the hands of terrorists. In this case, a raccoon terrorist. They had heard some scratching on the ceiling starting back in June, but this week the unthinkable happened. The ceiling in 9-year-old Enrique Gomez's bedroom gave way, and a large raccoon landed in bed with the boy. His parents ran in to see what all the screaming was about and got Enrique and his 5-year-old brother Jonathan out of the room. They then closed the door and called police. That's when the real destruction started. The raccoon tried to get out of the window and destroyed the window blinds and chewed almost all the wood on the window frame trying to get out. One wall showed traces of blood where the animal tried to claw its way through the drywall to escape from the room. Maria Gomez said, "The animal control woman said we had to throw all this stuff out because of the blood and feces everywhere in the room." The family was so distraught they decided to move to another apartment complex, hopefully one that is advertised as raccoon-free. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, is nothing sacred anymore? Iranian officials have just banned citizens from sporting mullets and other unacceptable Western hairstyles to prevent cultural invasion. They're issuing a list of appropriate haircuts for men, which include side-parted dos and, believe it or not, Elvis coifs. However, mullets, ponytails, and spike styles are not allowed. So if you're going to Iran for any particular reason, for a vacation, and by the way, if you're going to Iran for a vacation, it's time to get a new travel agent. But if you're going to Iran for whatever reason, get a haircut first. Okay, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, not many people can say they've gotten drunk with Rod Stewart in a closet. But pop culture historian Chris Epting can. He's just penned, "Hello, It's Me, Dispatches from a Pop Culture Junkie," published by Santa Monica Press, a book about all the weird run-ins he's had with celebrities. Chris joins us right now via the world of Skype-to-Skype communication all the way from California. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, Peter. How you been?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Hey, anytime.
So you've done a lot of books about traveling through the United States and also about baseball, but this one is slightly different than some of the things you've done. Tell us how this book came to be.
Well, for me, it's actually really different. A couple of years ago, a magazine asked me if I would contribute several short nonfiction pieces. And I asked what they wanted. And they said, any kind of narratives, just things from life that you might find interesting. So I sent them three stories. One involved an incident I had with Michael Jordan. Another one had a kind of a years-long episode with the great fiction writer John Cheever when I was young. And the third was the Rod Stewart, Ron Wood incident that you referenced in the setup. So I did those three stories. And they were each couple thousand words apiece, and it was a really fun experience doing it. I mean, I really enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to, because I'm always writing about history and places and things like that, and not focusing on experiences I've had. So after those three came out, my publisher read them, and he said, you know what, this is kind of a nice other side of you. What if you had to flesh these, you know, create a book of stories like this? Do you have enough? And I was thinking the exact same thing. I was, in fact, going to pitch him on that idea, because I had sketched out, like in one night on a yellow pad of paper, about 100 stories that I thought might have some relevance or, you know, just kind of an interesting peek behind the pop culture curtain. And so he said, great. And then that was about a year and a half or 2 years ago. And that's what resulted in this book. So it's not a road trip book per se like my others, but I keep calling it like a road trip through life. You know, it's a chance for not necessarily me to talk about me, which would not be interesting at all, but to showcase some of the people I've had the unique opportunity to either brush up against or get involved with on some level or you know, show some sort of insight. I mean, to that end, I even asked a lot of these people to contribute pieces to the book. So within the book, there's probably about 30 or so of the 75 stories, I think 30 little additions, submissions from people who are actually in the stories themselves.
Okay, so since we did the setup, as you mentioned earlier, I have to ask, how did you end up getting drunk in a closet with Rod Stewart?
My first job in life, I worked in advertising for years as a copywriter. And then a creative director. My very first job in New York City in the early 80s at an ad agency, an agency that ended up producing the very first MTV Music Video Award show in 1984. We had like a little production arm to the company. And we all got kind of cool, weird jobs for that couple of week period that the show was being produced. My job was to shadow and kind of write little bits for Dan Aykroyd, who was the co-host with Bette Midler, which again shows you, I think, in that nutshell, how pop culture has really changed. In the early 80s, having Dan Aykroyd and Bette Midler was kind of those were the hip people to have host a show, to show you how things have changed. But so for a couple of weeks, I just hung out with Dan Aykroyd. It would help him create little, you know, bits of copy he was going to read as a host and all that, but really just kind of keep him company. He was sort of a loner at that point. His wife wasn't in town yet. And I just hung out with him, and he had all these friends always coming around to visit him, one of which was Ron Wood. So the night before the show was the dress rehearsal night. Ron Wood grabbed me, and I'd gotten to know him now over the course of a couple of days, and he was desperate for a drink, and Dan Aykroyd had just quit drinking. So there was kind of a dry policy in the dressing room backstage at Radio City Music Hall. So Ron Wood kind of commandeered me, and we snuck in on our hands and knees into Bette Midler's dressing room, where she had booze, and we grabbed a bottle. I think it was Jack Daniels. And kind of snuck out literally on our hands and knees. We get to the hallway, and Ron Wood is walking through on his way to go see Dan Aykroyd. They, of course, have a great reunion. You know, they're good friends, of course, being in the Faces all those years before. And so Ron Wood says, come on, you can't drink back there. Come with us. So Ron Wood, in the hallway at Radio City, finds an old janitor's closet and opens the door, and the three of us go in. I'm just sort of getting swept along with this momentum. I think, you know, having pinched the bottle, I think that earned me a couple of points in his eyes. So the three of us sat in there for a while, just passing the bottle. Ron Wood was smoking a lot, so the only way I really saw their faces was in the glow of his cigarette, which was a really amazing kind of way to see them in this. Because I was remain a huge Rolling Stones fan and a big Faces fan. So to have these two iconic kind of Mount Rushmore rock and roll faces in that closet with me was something that just was, you know, really kind of mind-blowing. At the end of it, Rod Stewart says, hey, listen, you got to see what it's like. You know, we go through lots of crazy things, you know, day in, day out. Come with us for a minute. And they go over to a window in one of the dressing rooms, a second floor window. And on the street, there are already hundreds of kids who had gathered to watch the rock stars kind of come and go because word was out of the rehearsal was taking place. And they put me between them. And they kind of got the attention of the kids in the street, all these teenagers, who started going crazy when they saw Rod Stewart and in particular and Ron Wood. And they're whispering to me, could you get used to this? You know, isn't this fun, mate? And it was just this amazing little thing of being sort of dragged into their world for a minute. And I knew then at that point that story would somehow not just survive but hopefully make it into print at some point. So I was very happy. That was one of the showcase pieces in this book.
Now, another story that you have in the book, as I understand, you found yourself jumping on a trampoline with Sally Struthers.
Yeah.
I have to ask this question as delicately as possible, and that would be, how long ago was that?
This was probably, let me see, it's about 15 years ago. I met Sally 16 years ago. I met her at a party, and we got to talking. I have, like millions of other red-blooded males, had a mad crush on her in the 1970s when All in the Family was on. And we really hit it off. And she wasn't doing a lot of work at that point. And I was writing, like, hundreds of commercials. So I told her that I wanted to cast her in a bunch of things I was doing because I always found her very funny and very appealing. And through that, she and I just became really good friends. And I mean, today she's Aunt Sally to my kids, and you know we've known each other a long time now. But back then she had a huge trampoline. She lived in the old Hollywood mansion that was owned by Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth way back when. And in the back she had this like giant trampoline. And one night I had driven her home from something, and we'd had a couple. We were just kind of sitting out back, looking at the stars, talking about life and some sort of heavy issues. And she said, you know what? This is getting too serious. Let's go on the trampoline. And so sometime after midnight, we both got on there. And like just two little kids, you know, just jumped and then ended up kind of just lying down on the trampoline. Again, looking up at the stars, kind of talking about life. And again, one of those very strange pop culture iconic moments that you sort of pinch yourself as you're lying there thinking, how did things arrive at this point, you know?
Well, speaking of kids, I understand at the age of 11, you ran smack dab into Alfred Hitchcock's stomach.
I did. I was I grew up in New York, and we had just taken our first trip to California. My dad had a business trip. And so me and my two sisters and my mom, we all came along for the summer, 1974. And it was an amazing trip out because on our plane, you know, Paul Newman sat by me on the plane, which was kind of a big deal. And then we land and we go to the hotel and Gene Kelly is right in front of the hotel. So I'm thinking this is just how life is on the West Coast, that it's one series of iconic pop culture hero after another, you know. And true to that theory, a few minutes later, I'm running around the hotel, the Century Plaza Hotel, and a guy comes in the front door who I don't see, and I run like flush into his stomach. I literally kind of bounce off of it. And I always remember as a kid thinking there's two kinds of adults, the kind that will just sort of brush that off and laugh about it, and then those that get really ticked off. And this guy was the latter. This guy was not happy. And he quickly said to me, you know, where are your parents? Sort of yelling at me. And I look up and it's Alfred Hitchcock. And I indicate where my folks, they're checking in at the you know, in the lobby there. And he marches me over there kind of like, I mean, if he didn't pick up like the back of my neck the way like the dean would of some very proper English sporting school or something, that's how he kind of took me over there. My parents look across and see us coming, and they're thinking, how, you know, what's he gotten himself into? And Hitchcock made a brief speech to my parents about, you know, kids behaving in public and not running around. And I was a pretty quiet kid. I wasn't really doing anything. I think I was chasing my sister. It was not that big a deal. But I remember at that point thinking, you know, this is amazing. Here's a guy I'd seen. Why I used to love the Alfred Hitchcock Presents TV show when I was little. And here's that face. Here's that silhouette. But it's a real guy. It's not just some image on TV. This is just flesh and bone, you know. And so I remember thinking at that point that, A, I loved California for a lot of reasons. And that, B, these are just people, you know, they get sold to us as images in these sort of bigger than life presentations, but they're really just people, whether it was Paul Newman or Gene Kelly, or in that case, Alfred Hitchcock.
In putting this book together, Hello, It's Me, Dispatches from a Pop Culture Junkie, did you sit down and when you were doing it this book and think, wow, I've had a pretty interesting life?
I think that all the time. I mean, to be honest with you, I consider myself very fortunate, and I kind of break it down into about half of it or so being just pure dumb luck. And the other half being, you know, stuff that, like you work in media, you know, we get in enough situations as writers and journalists and things where there's going to be a few moments that are special that a lot of people don't have the opportunity to do. So to me, it was sort of a combination of those two things. Although in the book, there's a quote that I use from Branch Rickey, the former owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers. And it's that luck is the residue of a good design. And I always believe that if you set things up properly, good things will happen. You know what I mean? And so, again, part of it I know is just lucky. But other things, things I've had happen in life, I've tried to make happen and I've worked to make happen. And sometimes they pay off.
Well, we can have some of the fun living vicariously through some of the exploits you've had in your book. The book is called Hello, It's Me, Dispatches from a Pop Culture Junkie. It's written by Chris Epting, and I thank you once again, Chris, for being on the program with us.
Peter, thank you very much. As always, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Chris Epting, author of Hello, It's Me, Dispatches from a Pop Culture Junkie. You can check out Chris's website, chrisepting.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0051. And you can find links to his site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we have, of course, an idiot of the day in the Stuff File news. We're almost done with the show. The show just seems to fly right by very quickly. As a matter of fact, we're going to get to our next guest right now. Josh Robert Thompson is a comedian, voice, and television actor known for his uncanny celebrity impressions and outrageous original characters. He is perhaps best recognized as the voice of Craig Ferguson's robot skeleton sidekick, Jeff Peterson, on CBS's The Late Late Show. Josh joins us on the line right now. Hi, Josh. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
This is great to finally meet somebody with three names, just like me. I feel relieved.
Absolutely. One of the things I wanted to talk about is you do celebrity impressions. And I remember growing up as a kid, I grew up in the 60s. There were a lot of impressionists around, and that seemed to go by the wayside. And I have a theory about that, my theory being that in some cases, it's not the impressionists that were the problem. It's that the people that they were doing impressions of, when I was a kid, some of those people were larger than life, and celebrities today aren't necessarily that way.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I grew up watching guys like Rich Little. I caught the tail end of Rich Little's career as a kid, and certainly Fred Travellina. Freddie Travellina was, to me, one of the great impressionists of our time. He passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. He's a great guy. And I agree with you. Yeah, there were a lot of the celebrities that the guys were doing impressions of back then were actually very, very old. You know, I mean, guys like Jimmy Stewart. I mean, at the time that Rich Little was doing him, he was an old dude. So a lot of those guys, I think, also died out. But I would agree with you, there aren't many celebrities now that are worth doing impressions of, in my opinion.
How did you become an impressionist? And I hear this story often. A lot of people say they started doing impressions of their teachers.
Well, you know, eventually I did do impressions of my teachers in high school. But when I was young, about 7 or 8 years old, you know, I sort of caught the tail end of the variety show era. So I was watching a lot of Tim Conway, Carol Burnett, Rich Little, and studying what they were doing. And I was also an only child. That's a very important part of this. If you're an only child, it helps a lot because I had a lot of time on my hands. And I had a Fisher-Price tape recorder, and I would basically just record my voice into this tape recorder and mimic what I saw on television. So it was really just TV that inspired me to do this.
One of the things I find most fun about what you do an impression of Morgan Freeman, which is always fun.
Yes, that's right. Sometimes I can talk like Morgan Freeman. And you see, Morgan Freeman has a very commanding voice, and he could talk about anything, really. He could talk about old Cheerios with that beautiful white milk, the way it pours on those tiny O's. Yeah, Morgan Freeman is one of my favorites. I actually met Morgan Freeman at the Late Late Show. I finally met him, one of the great actors of our time, and somebody on the staff told him that I'd do his impression. And he said to me, "Hey, you know, that could come in handy someday." So I feel blessed. I've been honored by Morgan Freeman.
Well, what is the reaction of people, generally speaking, Morgan aside? Have you come in contact with other people of whom you do impressions of, and what's their reaction generally?
Yeah, I mean, Morgan's the only one. Schwarzenegger I met before I was actually doing the impression, before he was even running for governor, when he was just, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the actor. And I remember shaking his hand, saying, "It's a pleasure to meet you, Arnold," and he said something like, "Oh, fantastic. It's great to meet you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you." Little did he know that, you know, a year later I would be doing the Howard Stern show and pranking people as Governor Schwarzenegger. The one guy that I want to meet still is Robert De Niro. I do a more physical impression of Robert De Niro on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. If I could meet Robert De Niro, that would definitely be a coup for me.
Now, when it comes to the Late Late Show, is it a situation, a chicken or egg, which came first? Do you do impressions based on where your talents lie, or do they come to you and say, "Josh, we'd like you to see if you can do this"?
Yeah, it's the latter, because the writers found me. I was doing a public access show where I was playing one of my original characters, this preacher character that I do, and I was taking live phone calls, and the writer called me and said, "Hey, dude, do you do any other characters?" I said, "Arnold Schwarzenegger." He said, "Great, let's start with that." So it started with Arnold. It started with me just doing the voice of Schwarzenegger. Then they said, "Let's put you in a muscle suit and put some, you know, makeup on your face. Do you want to be on camera?" I said, "Sure." And now, because they've been doing the show for about 4 years, they definitely just throw things at me. "Hey, can you do this kind of voice? How about this kind of character?" You know, it's even in my voice career. That's I make a living as a person who does voice matching for movies. So if somebody needs like a celebrity matched for film, like I just did The Expendables, I did Mickey Rourke's voice. I didn't know I could do Mickey Rourke's voice, but I can listen to these people and I can replicate them pretty authentically. So yeah, that's exactly what it is.
In addition to being an impressionist, I mean, to do what you do, you also have to be an actor. So is it easier for you to be Josh Robert Thompson, the actor, or Josh Robert Thompson being somebody else famous as an actor?
Yeah, you know, I don't consider myself to be an impressionist. I mean, I do about 5 pretty good impressions. I prefer to be, you know, myself, the actor, because I do a lot of video games and I do a lot of animated television shows. And in those cases, I'm called on to do original characters. So I have to come up with an original voice. And with my voice, with nothing else, I have to paint the picture. I have to create the character with just sound so that the listener
really gets the sense of who this character is. That's a bigger challenge for me, because you also have to perform in scenes. When you record these in these recording sessions, none of the other actors are there. So not only are you taking on a different voice and a different persona, but you're acting to nothing. That's the better challenge for me. I really enjoy doing that.
Now, getting back to the Late Late Show, I alluded to in the introduction the voice of Jeff Peterson, the robot skeleton. How did that character come out?
Yeah, well, this is awesome. Back in April, Craig Ferguson had this robot built for him for the show. Now, Craig had been joking about a robot skeleton army, one of his silly jokes. And Grant Imahara from the TV show Mythbusters, Grant is an amazing builder of robots and machines. He knew that Craig was a huge fan of Mythbusters, and so he built this robot skeleton sidekick. And it started on April 5th. It debuted on the show, and Craig Ferguson was doing the voice of the robot. And he was doing a very robotic voice like this, sort of like one of the Daleks from Doctor Who. And that lasted about 2 weeks, and Craig got tired of it because Craig basically knew everything the robot was going to say. In other words, these phrases are pre-recorded and played back during the show. So Craig, and I was very honored by this, came to me and said, will you do the voice of Jeff Peterson? Come up with a new voice for this character. I want you to do it because I want to be surprised. I don't want to know what Jeff is going to say. Jeff can say up to 14 different phrases per episode, and it's all pre-recorded by me. So the writer said, why don't you do like a George Takei? Why don't you kind of make him sound like this? Oh, my. Oh, Craig. Oh, dear. And that voice stuck, and Craig loves it. And now Jeff Peterson is on every night on the show. We just went to Comic-Con in San Diego at the CBS booth for 3 hours taking questions and answers, you know, with the audience members as Jeff Peterson. People love this character. So it's definitely the biggest thing that's happened for me in my career, being someone who loves late-night TV. Johnny Carson, Red Skelton, Milton Berle, Bob Hope. I'm so honored to be like the sidekick, the Ed McMahon to Craig Ferguson, even though I'm a robot skeleton.
Do you get noticed at all? Do people know Josh Robert Thompson, or are they surprised when they find out who you are and the characters you've done?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think now because of the Late Late Show and Jeff Peterson, certainly because of our Comic-Con appearance, people are starting to know who I am. They're starting to connect my name with Jeff Peterson. But the thing about my work is mostly I'm hidden. I'm either behind a microphone in a studio, or I'm wearing lots of makeup as Schwarzenegger or De Niro or some other character. So it's a double-edged sword. It's kind of like I like to be hidden. I like to wear a lot of makeup. I like to become the character. But I also want people to know who's responsible for these things. But, man, it's definitely happening. In fact, Craig Ferguson is now following me on Twitter, which apparently means something in this world. So I got hundreds of people now that know who I am. So I'm very honored. I really am. If people recognize me on the street, that's cool. But if they also watch the shows I'm on, that's even better.
Who's your favorite voice?
The favorite voice that I do?
Yeah.
The favorite impression that I do is definitely Morgan Freeman. That's a very tough one to do. There's maybe one other guy that does it. But I certainly feel that I do it the most realistically. I just, even Morgan Freeman approves of it, so I don't think you can go much higher than that. But as far as original character voices go, I enjoy, my preacher character, the Apostle B.G., who talks like this, Holy Ghost power, this is the Apostle B.G. coming at you right here, holding this preacher. I'm a beacon of light of the Lord, man. I'm a conduit through which the Lord speaks. Praise the Lord. I love that guy. That's my favorite character in the entire world to do. I do him as a stand-up comic. It's kind of like an Andy Kaufman, Phil Hartman thing. I just totally become that character. But yeah, Morgan Freeman, definitely my favorite impression, if I had to say, for sure.
Well, growing up as a lonely child, as an only child, certainly you didn't grow up as a lonely child with all the voices you had a chance to do. Josh, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. I really appreciate you having me on. This has been a lot of fun.
Actor and impressionist Josh Robert Thompson. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And before we wrap things up on this edition of the Stuff File, we do indeed have an idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
This clown came up with the worst excuse you'll ever hear. In Sarasota, Florida, 39-year-old Gerald Maxwell is back behind bars after being charged with burglary and violation of probation. Maxwell had already been convicted of burglarizing a residence last year, and police arrested him as they caught him breaking into the exact same home again. Maxwell later told police, "I was going back in there to leave a thank you note because I'm the guy who burglarized this place last year. I just got out of jail." Officers investigating the incident found a broken window, multiple dresser drawers open, and jewelry collected near a crack pipe. Why would someone who just got out of jail for robbing a place go back and rob the exact same place? Oh, there's just one reason and one reason only. Gerald Maxwell, you're an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0051. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. And stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, it's 0051. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me at Facebook at facebook.com/PA Holder and Twitter at twitter.com/PA Holder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, streaming on PCJMedia.com, and over the air at World FM 88.2 in New Zealand and Gold FM 90.5 in Singapore. Don't forget to donate. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson.
What am I being paid for this?
What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.